Welcome to The Romantic Side of Suspense with Sarah Hammaker. In each episode, she'll talk with your favorite romantic suspense authors. They will take you behind the scenes of the writing process, giving excerpts from their writing, and share stories about their writing life.
The Paris Betrayal by James R. Hannibal. As a former tactical deception officer and stealth pilot, James R. Hannibal brings a wealth of knowledge to his electrifying new thriller, The Paris Betrayal. Brimming with elite enemies, abandoned agents, and global espionage, Hannibal propels readers into a world where double-crossing is standard and failing to be at the top of your game could cost you your life. After a rough mission in Rome involving the discovery of a devastating bioweapon, company spy Ben Kallax returns to Paris to find his orderly world has collapsed. Faced with an ambush, repeated attacks, and a futile call for help, Ben is released from the agency. Caught in the crossfire of Ben's misfortunes and his search for answers, his neighbor Clara is forced to join him in his search. Together, they must hunt down the sniper who tried to kill him, the medic who saved his life, the schoolmaster who trained him, and the upstart hacker he blames for his problems. Will this eclectic group of characters be able to provide the answers Ben seeks? And can he combat the infection that is swiftly claiming territory within his own body?
Hi, and welcome to this episode of The Romantic Side of Suspense. I'm your host, Sarah Hammaker, and I'm glad you joined me. Today, I'm talking with author James R. Hannibal, who is no stranger to secrets and adventure, and I'm looking forward to having a conversation about your suspense writing. So welcome to my show, James.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
So, now, your bio, which our listeners can access with this podcast, says that you were a former stealth pilot. So I have to ask, does that just mean you flew planes that were stealthy, or is there a specific genre, so to speak, of pilots that are stealth as opposed to, I don't know, other pilots? I'm curious.
I am very sneaky. Ask my kids.
Okay.
I flew fighters in Europe for a little bit, and then I moved into the stealth bomber wing, the 509th bomber.
Okay.
And flew as an operational pilot, an instructor, and a test pilot in the stealth bomber.
So now, do you use that background in your writing?
Oh, sure. Especially in spy thrillers like The Paris Betrayal, and the Talia Inger series and the Nick Barron series, because they have a lot of technical aspects, especially in particular the Nick Barron series was set in a stealth test squadron for a new piece of technology. The funny thing about that is if you follow military tech, the new bomber that's shortly coming out called the B-21 Raider, back when I was there, it was a highly classified program called the Next Generation Long Range Strike. We were a think tank working with DARPA to come up with ideas, and then it became, once we determined that the next strike capability was going to be a bomber, then it became the Next Generation Bomber. But a lot of what went into the tech in the Nick Barron series was things that I got permission to use that were originally concepts we came up with in the think tank for the B-21 Raider.
Oh, that's kind of cool. So, I mean, so you kind of have a lot of own personal knowledge and probably connections to ensure that your books have that accuracy. I mean, I may not know the difference, you know, because I'm not a, I was never a stealth pilot. But there are people out there who would. So how else do you kind of make sure that your books are at least in the realm of definite possibilities and accurate as possible?
Well, you know, I spent, obviously, in a 15-year career, I covered fighters, bombers, and drones. I covered stealth technology, sensors. I worked with additional agencies in some extracurricular activities. And so I do have that background. I have those contacts. I also have the advantage of knowing where to look for unclassified information to verify things that I say. And usually, you know, a lot of stuff, I like to stay on the edge. I like to stand just beyond what's now, which means that I take what is happening right now and I push it a little bit further. You see that more in the Talia Inger series than in the Paris Betrayal, because that's more of a guy relying on his wits spy with Dutton the Cold thing. But what enables me to do that, one, is knowing where to look, what the sources are, the publications being still put out by these agencies with unclassified information. I follow those. I'm on their newsletters. And so I'm always staying on the forefront of what's happening right now.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, must be helpful to kind of, like you said, know where to look, because we know a lot of information is out there, and thank goodness for the World Wide Web. I mean, I just don't know how writers, I really have a lot of respect for writers who, you know, had to go to libraries for everything. I mean, because librarians are great, and I'm often calling them going, hey, where can I find this? But, you know, it's just so much at our fingertips. Do you ever just think and go, wow, it's a lot we can find out.
For Wraith, you know, I started writing Wraith in 2006, so I spent, this was long before we had this many resources on the web, and especially for the specific things I was looking for. So I traveled to Washington, D.C., I spent time in libraries all over the country, with the old note card, you know, pile. I finally, my wife made me get rid of them, but I used to have basically a trash bag full of note cards of research for that first book.
Yeah, I know. I'm a fan of note cards. I was probably one of the only kids in my class who was excited. Research paper, yes! So I can definitely understand the allure of the note card for that. But I when I think about how much writing has, you know, evolved with the ability of the web and everything, I kind of shudder, and you probably maybe have a little more knowledge about this, just given your background, of some of the things I look for on the web, like, you know, how to kill people. So, and I think, I hope nobody, I'm an author, I'm looking up poison because I need to know this for my book. But do you research mostly on the web for how to kill people in your books, or where's your go-to for that kind of information?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I received a lot of training on how to kill people, so sometimes
yeah,
I don't.
Yeah, the personal knowledge? Okay.
But I do. And actually, you know, for me, the cringeworthy web stuff is not the how to kill people, especially lately, because I'm working on a new Maui mystery that involves a doctor, and so I had to do a neurosurgery scene. And I had, I wanted it to be like the worst case scenario. So I had to watch 3 actual neurosurgeries. And hey, thanks to the web, they're right there available to us. You can go on YouTube or on a medical on a hospital site, and you can watch somebody get their head cracked open and somebody dig around in their brain. And you know that one, that's hard for me to watch.
Yeah. So did you find a good way to kill someone then, watching that, or something,
well,
a way to go wrong?
Save somebody's life.
Okay.
I found a good way to almost kill them with a critical emergency during a surgery, and then how the doctor would repair that if he were a top neurosurgeon.
Well, that's helpful in case you ever want to, you know, start a new life as a neurosurgeon.
Right. Yeah. Just, you know, third, fourth career.
Yeah. I often think that as authors, because we have to get all this knowledge, you know, sometimes I think the weird facts that I tell my kids at the dinner table, they're not as excited about it as I am. But I'm like, okay, I just learned this today. And they're like, Mom, that is just not exciting. But just the knowledge that we gain. So I think that's always fun to kind of gather that and have that floating around in our brains. But how
absolutely.
Do you...
I get the same thing from my kids, too.
Yeah, I know. They're like, we don't want to hear that. And one of my... my younger sister is a nurse in the Air Force, and sometimes she'll come and... She's at Walter Reed now and doing medevac, which is kind of exciting. I think I need to write that in one of my stories. So I have a couple of books down the line. I think I'm going to be picking her brain for that. But she'll come and share some stories. I have to tell her, no, I can't hear the blood part. if I need to know, I'll let you know, but I don't really want to know. Sometimes it's too much information for me. But how do you find time to write? I'm assuming, you have a busy life. I'm always curious to see how authors work writing into their life. How do you do that?
Well, I actually just recently wrote a blog on that for Blue Ridge Mountain Christian Writers Conference because I got so many demands currently that it sort of got out of control. I'm an on-call pilot for a major airline. I took over the intellectual property for a fantasy world from the 1980s, and I've become a game developer. And then I have two running book series right now. And so it really, between the marketing and everything else, finding actual time to write the books became very difficult. And what I finally had to do was realize that my wife is so much better at organization and schedules and maintaining a pace than I am. In the past, I did, I've often asked her for help, but what I realized is I had to give her control. And so I had to completely put my trust in her, not to be the manager of my schedule, but to be the boss. And to say, I was trying to be the soldier and the general at the same time.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That doesn't work. When you have to be the soldier, then you need someone else to be the general, and that's what we realize. And that's been very effective. I've had the most productive last couple of months in my entire career by just letting go of control and letting her take over.
Yeah, I just. Just hearing you talk about that, James, just brings to mind that, it's just so true. It can be applied to many of things. But as writers, we do need to make sure that if we can't manage our schedule, that we get outside help to with that. I don't know about, many writers I talked to with the pandemic, it felt like it was so hard to write, like you were trying to write through, like, sludge or something for many months. And I just realized, several months ago in the fall, I was like, I am not writing as much as I want to. It was my own fault, I'll take full responsibility. So I decided I needed to, upend my schedule and make it that be the priority, and that has been very helpful. So I have been more productive in this time because just doing that. I think it can be difficult sometimes. We get too close to it. And we don't realize we talk about writing more than we're actually writing.
Sure, yeah.
So what's your favorite spot for reading or reflecting if you on your current work in progress? Do you have a place that you kind of go to? What's your kind of, how do you get that reflection part?
Well, Honolulu or Maui, usually. So as an airline pilot, what I end up doing is, what takes me away from my desk is when somebody calls in sick and I go on to fill in for them.
Okay.
And actually, the COVID has not done me any favors as far as schedule because usually I'm on call, usually I fly a couple of times a month. And the rest of the time I can devote to writing and working on the game business. But in COVID, the flail of the airlines trying to keep up with the economic changes and everything else, they flushed a bunch of pilots into lower paying seats into different airplanes and then flushed us all right back. So the end result of that is a 10-week giant black hole in my schedule when I'm training into different types of aircraft. That has really put a damper on my writing this year. But when I do fly, I usually take audiobooks. I use an app called VoiceStream to, I convert either my writing or someone else's writing if they send me a PDF. Usually what I read these days is pre-published books that are have yet to hit the shelves. And so I listen to those books on the VoiceStream while I'm on my crew rest breaks and things like that while flying. So, I do long-haul flying, so, we don't do that in the flight deck, but when I go on my break in the crew bunk or wherever, then I listen to a book during that time.
Yeah, I love audiobooks. I fell in love with them when my kids were little. I have four children, and they were playing nicely, but I didn't always want to hear them when I was cooking dinner. So I just fell in love with audiobooks, carrying around my little portable CD player back in the day. Just listening to them. I just love audiobooks. And it seems kind of funny to me that they have like seen this big resurgence in the last year or so, where everyone seems to be talking about audiobooks. Have you found that to be true?
That for us as homeschool parents, that's we were tuned into that a while back. We recognize that everybody has a different learning. Some people are visual learners, some people are auditory learners. We can all learn either way, but depending on who you are, you retain information better, either visually or by hearing it in various ways. I and my sons are auditory learners, so we retain information better, engage with information better when we hear it rather than read it. And so we love audiobooks. And I think as we become more in tune to that sort of thing, the rest of the world is too, and so you see the growth of audiobooks.
Yeah, I know, and I love that we have all these options. My kids love to listen to audio music or books or stories. There was this thing called Rabbit Ears, which were like fairy tales retold in an audio form, more like audio, a little bit like audio theater that we checked out from the library when they were younger. And they just love that kind of oral tradition that you can kind of, encapsulate in a CD player or now on your phone or something. I think it's just kind of magical to sit and just listen. I love to do it as an adult too. I'm always listening to an audiobook, always looking, trying to, I usually have two going, one for my car, cause my car is so old, I can't plug in my phone. So I still have a CD player that works, and one on my phone that I can listen around the house. So I just think it's so much fun to have those options. Are any of your books in audio form?
All of my books except for The Clockwork Dragon are in audio form.
Okay.
So yeah, you can pretty much get those on any of the audio providers.
Cool.
Except for The Clockwork Dragon, which I have the rights for, and I have not assigned somebody to do it.
Yeah, that can be quite a production, I think, to do it by yourself. I hired someone to do the excerpt to do a voice narration excerpt for my podcast, because I don't want to hear myself read the excerpt. That would not be good. So I just love that I can include that little bit with the interview, and hopefully people will be interested in hearing other audio of it. So I think we have time for one more question. So I want to know, which of your books is your favorite and why? I always love hearing when authors have multiple books. I mean, I know it's like picking which of your children is your favorite, but which one do you really like?
Well, it is. I say it's like that with your kids. But for me, it's really what I'm working on. I'm in love with what I'm writing at the time. The two that I just finished, which were Paris Betrayal and Wolf Soldier, which are, two different genres, so it's hard to compare with apples and oranges in terms of favorites, right? But both of those are sort of like an opus for me. One in my fantasy, I've been waiting since I was 14 for to put Wolf Soldier out there. I've been waiting for years and years to do The Paris Betrayal, which is almost, it's got that how to be a spy feel, because you're really seeing his internal thoughts, when what's going through his mind, relying and recalling his training as he's forced to survive on his own out in the cold, cut off from all his resources. So both of those for me were real works from deep within the heart and soul. And so right now those are my favorites.
Oh, well, great. So I will look forward to, in The Paris Betrayal, that is available now.
It is. It releases May 4th.
May 4th, right. Well, thank you so much for being on my show, James. I really appreciate chatting with you.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
You've been listening to The Romantic Side of Suspense. I'm your host, Sarah Hammerker, and I've been talking with James R. Hannibal about his books and writing and flying as well. Stay tuned for an excerpt from his latest book, The Paris Betrayal.
Now an excerpt from The Paris Betrayal by James R. Hannibal. Piazza del Popolo, Rome, present day. From a rooftop perch, Ben Kallax watched the courier leave the Tiber and cross the piazza. He traced his scope from the man's temple down to his forearm. No cuffs secured his wrist to the steel briefcase. Foolish. Ben's team had been tracking that case since Morocco. This morning, they'd claim their treasure.
Micro, Saber has eyes on.
I hate that call sign.
Ben frowned in Dylan's direction. His young Welsh hacker-slash-technician out of sight and grumbling in the ancient sewer beneath Rome's Piazza del Popolo. Smelly, but warmer than Ben's post. The night's frost still whitened the stone lip of the roof. He shivered, returning his eye to the scope.
Now is not the time, Micro. Right, sorry. Micro copies your eyes on call. I'm flipping the switch. The system is hot.
The day's first tourists filtered out onto the streets. The early risers and the overzealous fathers dragging bleary-eyed kids. In this city, even in the dead of winter, an operative could always count on a crowd. Rome, the true neutral ground of the espionage world. The Swiss claim neutrality, but everyone knows they have an underlying conscience. Rome does not. The Italians maintain a true laissez-faire approach. Americans, Russians, Iranians, everyone does their own thing with impunity. Bullets must fly in the open streets for the Italian cops to take an interest. Ben dialed in the scope's rangefinder.
Nightingale, he's 20 meters out. You're on.
Giselle Laurent, a platinum blonde for this op and sporting faux fur, tipped her oversized sunglasses down the bridge of her nose.
I see him. Poor little man.
She set off from her post at the piazza's Sphinx fountain on a course to intercept.
See, Dylan said, jamming up the comms. That's what I'm talking about. The company gave you Saber like you're the tip of the spear or something. Miss Tall, questionably blonde and gorgeous gets Nightingale. And what do I get? Micro. What are they implying? They're implying you're short. Shut up, she's almost there.
Ben wiggled a black box in his fingers, as if the kid could see it.
The thing you gave me. Do I need to point it like a TV remote? A TV remote? Nice, Grandpa. I'm barely 30.
You're making my point. It's not a TV remote or a gun. No need to point it at anything. The antenna is omnidirectional.
Sure, the antenna.
Ben turned the box over and found a black rubber nub buried in a hole in the top. He grabbed it with his teeth and pulled.
Got it.
Down in the piazza, Giselle hit her target full on with a cappuccino. Ben winced at her squeal, piercing despite the comm link's static. She bellowed at the target in French about fur coats and coffee stains, poking him in the chest. He backed away. Expertly steered into a lamppost with a false utility box Dylan had placed there the night before. Trapped, the courier set his case down to fend off the crazy fur lady. In the middle of her tirade, Giselle spoke the trigger word, mink. Ben pressed the switch. By the time the courier reached for his case again, Dylan's contraption had swapped it with a duplicate. Same make and weight, thanks to Giselle's photos and Dylan's calculations. A moment later, Ben heard the buzz of a motorbike in his earpiece. Dylan tearing away through the sewers with the prize.
Micro has the package. Contents look good. I'm off. Ben didn't envy the courier. Poked and swatted by Giselle before breakfast and destined for a pre-lunch beating once the buyer opened a case full of blank papers and empty steel tubes. But he'd brought the beating on himself with his sins. Ben and Giselle wouldn't interfere. They'd need to watch the buyer to see what he did next, now that they'd messed with his world. With the real case in hand and the buyer under surveillance, the company would finally get a trace on the organization behind the destruction in Munich, St. Petersburg, and Tokyo. Each strike built upon the ferocity and death toll of the last until Rotterdam, when the bomber had botched his job and killed only himself. Rotterdam was the break the company needed. An undetonated fragment proved the attacks involved a new type of explosive, CRTX, 5 times as powerful as C4 and previously considered impossible to make. With the bomb compound identified, the company field operatives went into overdrive searching for leads. Ben found the big one. An Algerian contact in its home base of Paris hinted at an order of rare chemicals heading to a bomb maker. Ben put a hasty mission together, pulling in Giselle and the company's top tinker, Dylan. The Algerian's info led them to the case, and the case led them here.
"Micro," Ben said, laying his scope in its case. "That's a job well done. Enjoy the flight home. Nightingale, keep tabs on the target.
A shadow darkened Ben's perch. Strong arms flipped him over and slammed him down, breaking roof tiles. A brute stood over him. Bald, Arab, packing a cig.
"Enjoying the show, Mr. Calix?"
"Monsieur?"
The Algerian, the criminal from Paris whose rumor about an order of bomb-making chemicals led Ben to the case. Ben feigned relief and exasperation and rolled onto his shoulder, hiding his hand in his coat pocket.
"Did you follow me?"
He didn't give Monsieur a chance to answer. In a snap motion, Ben reversed his body and used the momentum to scissor the Algerian's legs from beneath him. The cig flew from Monsieur's hand. Scrambling over the tiles, Ben pinned him down, one knee on an arm, and the other across his chest. His left hand brushed Monsieur's side, leaving behind a gift. Monsieur swung a knife. Ben jerked his face back and caught the man's wrist. He clamped a hand over the fingers, trapping the blade.
"Bad idea."
A strike to the elbow bent Monsieur's arm, and with both hands, Ben pressed the knife down until the tip found Monsieur's Adam's apple.
"When we met in Paris, I used an alias. How did you know my real name?"
"Jupiter has been watching you. Is pleased."
Screams hit Ben's ears. 2 versions of the same scream. One live and one over the comlink. Giselle.
"Saber, this is Micro!"
The echoing howl of a motorbike in a sewer pipe nearly drowned out Dylan's voice.
"Something's wrong! No kidding! Should I go back? And do what?"
Ben knocked Monsieur out with a right cross.
"You never carry a gun!"
He launched himself over the ledge and rode the fire escape down until it clanked against its stop, leaving him dangling 5 feet above the pavement. He dropped to the ground in a crouch.
"Go, Dylan! Get out of here!"
Ben rose and turned. The crowd before him scattered, some running for their lives. 50 meters away, a red-haired man the size of a small house held Giselle by the neck, dragging her backward toward a runabout bobbing against the Tiber River docks. Ben charged. Giselle's attacker raised a cig like Monsieur's to her neck.
"Stay back, I'll kill her!"
Without slowing, Ben drew a Glock and leveled it.
"Not a chance!"
Thanks for listening to The Romantic Side of Suspense with Sarah Hammerker. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. You can sign up to receive notifications of upcoming podcasts and listen to previous editions at sarahhamakerfiction.com.